Welcome to Zuma Clock with your host, Tessie Anthony de Nassau. This podcast brings you enlightening discussions with leading experts and public figures directly to your ears.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Zuma Clock with your host, Tessie Anthony de Nassau. Today's guest is a fantastic, inspiring, and hardworking human being, Christian. Christian, how are you?
Hi, Tessie. Very good. Thank you.
So, for the people who haven't heard about you yet from our announcements on social media, let me introduce you. Professor Dr. Christian Busch is the best-selling author of The Serendipity Mindset, The Art and Science of Creating Good Luck. A wise, exciting, and life-changing book quoted by Arianna Huffington, founder of the Huffington Post, that provides excellent practical guides for all. Paul Polman, former CEO of Unilever, and an internationally known expert in the area of innovation, purpose-driven leadership, and serendipity. He is the director of the CJA Global Economy Program at the New York University, NYU, and also teaches at the London School of Economics, LSE. He is a co-founder of Leaders on Purpose and the Sandbox Network, and a former co-director of LSE Innovation Lab. He is a member of the World Economic Forum's WEF Expert Forum, a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, and on the Thinkers 50 radar list of the top 30 thinkers most likely to shape the future. Wow, Christian, what a bio. This is exceptional. It's so nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
So let's shoot right off. I have a lot of questions for you and we don't have much time. What led you to research serendipity and why is it important?
Well, I grew up in Heidelberg and I used to be that rebellious teenager. I was thrown out of high school, had to repeat a year, and then transferred this into my driving style and probably held the unofficial world record of how many dustbins you can knock over on your way to school when you're driving. And then one day wasn't so lucky anymore and crashed into four parked cars, all cars completely destroyed, including my own. And I won't forget the policeman who came to the scene and he was like, oh my God, he's still alive. And you know, that idea that I was supposed to be dead, that stuck with me. And I asked myself all these weird questions. If I would have died, who would have come to my funeral? Who would have actually cared? Was it all worth it? And at that point, I had mostly depressing answers. And so it took me on this intense search for meaning, trying to figure out what is life all about. And I started reading an amazing book, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which is all about how do you find meaning in crisis and tough moments. And what I realized then over time is that I find a lot of meaning in connecting ideas, connecting people, and the sparks that come from doing that. And so it took me on a journey as community builder, as entrepreneur, and then academia. And what I found fascinating is that the most inspiring, interesting people, they seem to have something in common, which is that they somehow intuitively cultivate serendipity. They're extremely good at seeing something in unexpected moments and then connecting the dots and turning it into positive outcomes. And so the question became, hey, is there a science-based framework for this? Is there a science behind this serendipity? Because we know it in our lives. Some have it more than others. But hey, what if we could build a muscle for this? And so that's really what I'm most excited about at the moment.
Wow, that is amazing. But, you know, not everyone knows what serendipity is. So tell me, as of the research you have been doing, what is serendipity exactly?
Well, it's really usually when we think about luck, we think about something that just happens to us, right? So it's kind of birth lottery, all these kind of things we can't really pick, and they create a lot of societal inequality. And then there's serendipity, which is active luck, which is essentially the idea that we can create the luck ourselves based on our mindset. Example? Imagine you have erratic hand movements like I do, then you spill a lot of coffee, right? And so imagine you accidentally spill a coffee in a coffee shop over the person next to you, and that person looks at you slightly angrily, but you sense there might be something there. You don't know what it is, you just sense there might be something there, and now you have a couple of options, right? One option is you just say, I'm so sorry, you walk outside, and you think, what could have happened had I spoken with that person, The other option is you start that conversation and that person becomes the love of your life or your co-founder or your next investor. The point is our reaction to the unexpected, making the accident meaningful, is what serendipity is about. And so that's the exciting thing. Once we see that serendipity is a process of seeing some kind of unexpected thing, but then doing something with it, we can either create more of these positive collisions, and we can definitely talk about a couple of strategies, or we can learn how to make more out of those random things that already happened.
That is amazing. I think, you know, listening to what you're saying, I think moments of serendipity that I could identify straight away in my mind was definitely the moment I met my ex-husband, His Royal Highness Prince Louis of Luxembourg, when I checked his eyes in the military. And I saw that he was kind of like blinking through the blinds. And I said to him, well, I could have busted him and say, okay, you cheated. You know, this is not how it works, and let him fall through the exam. But I thought, you know, I really sensed and I was really drawn to him. And I was like, let's see. And maybe we can go for coffee or something like that. And he said yes, to my surprise. And, 12 years of marriage and two beautiful boys later, that was definitely a moment like that. But even my husband now, Frank, so I remarried. I believe that that serendipity is really all around us. I was single for 2 years, and I remember telling my mom, I'm never going to find a guy. I said, I don't know, it just doesn't happen, but, you know. And that day, you know, for some reasons, all of these factors came together, and I was really tired, and there was an event in the evening. And I said to a friend, there's an event, I get asked to go. And he's like, you know, I'll come with you. And I said, okay. And I thought to myself, and I remember it still today, if he comes with me, how random is that? Then I must go. And there must be something there that I need to go, that even the universe is telling me he should come with me, you know, that I don't have an excuse really to say, oh, no, I can't go now. So I went and I met him there. And there again, I was so drawn to him without even seeing him, to a corner in the room with hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. And there he was standing with his glass of wine, very shy in the corner. And I went up and spoke to him. So, yeah, I think these moments are all the time with us, but we don't. You know, not knowing the definition of it, as you say, you don't always see them as such. So, question. So, you said we could do some strategies on it, maybe. So, what are ways to cultivate serendipity for you? Where you say, let's say the top three. If you try these, or one that works for you, or one that speaks to you while listening to this recording, this will bring you serendipity.
Yeah, definitely. So there's a lot of strategies, but yeah, I'll focus on three. First of all, also, I think you embody this, right? You embody the mindset a lot. I think you intuitively connect a lot of dots and make, you know, in a way also trust the process, right? I think that's obviously a really interesting one. It's one of my kind of absolute favorite strategies is the hook strategy. And the hook strategy is about saying, whenever someone asks you a question like, what do you do, right? The kind of questions that usually put you into a box. Yeah. Think about what could be two or three things that are interests of you that you just want to put out there so that they can take the one they are most interested in. So someone who does that really good is Ollie Barrett. He's an entrepreneur in London. If you would ask him at a conference or somewhere else, what do you do? He wouldn't just say, I'm an entrepreneur. He would say, I'm an entrepreneur in the education sector, recently started reading into the philosophy of science, but what I'm really excited about is playing the piano. And so what he's doing here is he's giving you three potential hooks where you could be like, oh my God, such a coincidence. Our CEO is hosting piano sessions on Friday. You should stop by. Oh my God, such a coincidence. My husband is teaching at the ETH Zurich. You should come by and give a guest lecture. And so we can all think in our own lives, what are two or three curiosities, interests that whenever someone asks you, whatever they ask, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing pretty well. I just wrote a book about coincidence, but I'm really excited now about, you know, education because my daughter just came into the world and I wanted to learn more about how to do it, right? So it's kind of like you can build those depending on context. I was in Hamburg recently. In Hamburg, you use 0.5 hooks, and then in New York, you use 20 hooks. So it depends, of course, but depending on the context.
Yeah, because that is true. That is a valid point, because when I talk to people then and they say, what do you do? And I have heard where individuals, elderly men, for example, say to me, Tessie, this is amazing, but don't don't do that. He says, you're overwhelming people. It's too much. They don't know how to cope with you. You're scaring them. And then I'm like, okay. So yeah, it is exactly like you need to feel what feels right. But how do you know that?
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly it, right? To feel right, what's right in a context, what can people like cope with, but also what's right for you, right? What feels authentic. Like you don't want to be that kind of, because the beautiful thing is the idea of the hook strategy is that you get away from pitching, that you get away from, I have this one story I have to pitch you, to, no, I'm trying to build a relationship with you. And to give an example, that actually then paradoxically leads to the most beautiful things, right? So to give an example, there was a gaming entrepreneur and he tried it out when he went to a big conference and when someone asked him, what do you do? He would be like, oh, I'm a gaming entrepreneur. But what I'm actually really excited about is the metaverse and black holes. And so he just put it out there. And then the other guy was like, oh my God, such a coincidence. I'm such a big fan of black holes. Let's talk about it. They nerded it out for an hour. And then after an hour, the other person asks him, hey, I really like you. How can I help you? And then he's like, well, I'm looking for investment. Oh, wow. I'm an investor. Like, I can introduce you to other investors. Like, no problem. The point is, if you had pitched that guy and had said, hey, I have this amazing gaming solution, you're one of 1,000 people who pitch it. But if you're the person, the one person who actually builds a meaningful relationship, then actually it's also much more likely that everything else becomes more beautiful. And I think that's kind of underlying the serendipity mindset is also, let's build more meaningful relationships that are less transactional, less kind of like, here's something I can give you and something I want from you, to, no, let's connect on the things we really care about. And then the really beautiful projects will happen anyways, because we trust each other and build cool things. And so it's kind of, in a way, that shift away from transactional to more meaningful. But, you know, I think another strategy, and that's really something that is super interesting at the moment in brain science, especially, right? Because brain science and psychology, where this whole idea of neuroplasticity, where you can literally adjust your brain and you can train your brain. And so I'm a big fan, for example, my wife, we talked about Lexi earlier.
Joe Dispenza.
I'm sorry, the
Dr. Joe Dispenza.
So Lexi, yeah, well, but Lexi is exactly, so she, you know, has serendipity all the time. And people always like are, oh, do you have to be optimistic for serendipity? Do you have to somehow be always in a good mood? Absolutely not. I mean, she's the most amazing woman in the world, but not always like the most kind of optimistic or so, but she has always serendipity. Why? Because she's really good at seeing associations, at connecting dots. And so, you know, whenever you would talk with her about, hey, I have a new podcast, and then she would be like, oh my God, I want to introduce you to someone, or I want to bring one idea and so on. And so I'm a big fan of training ourselves, you know, for example, the next 10, 15 conversations, think about one idea you can bring into the conversation, one introduction you can make for that person to someone else. And if you think about that proactively a couple of times, your brain adjusts to that. And then it sees more and more of those connections. And then you start seeing dots everywhere. And that's kind of like, in a way, you know, what happens a lot of times is that people say, oh, but I'm not necessarily that kind of person or that kind of person. But we can now show, no, like you can literally train yourself to become that person.
That is so interesting. And it really, you know, we would call them in the traditional way super connectors. Mm-hmm. But actually, if you could call them, you know, serendipity experts, mm-hmm. because, yeah, it's really true. I would have never categorized serendipity to be this, to be honest with you. I think mm-hmm. it's fantastic. Very mm-hmm. interesting. And I cannot wait to meet your wife, because you did the hook on me when we were talking offline about, you know, and people don't know that because it wasn't recorded yet, but I will share it here because it is valuable. And it fits in the conversation that when we started a conversation, you said, oh, we are celebrating an achievement. And at the same, you were talking about, you know, do you know this new bed? And I was saying, yes, I know. I used it and I loved it. You know, with Theodor, it's that bed, for people who don't know yet, it's a bed that moves. And it makes sounds, because we with this new bed, you believe in the fourth trimester. So there's three trimesters in the womb, and there's the fourth trimester, which kind of like helps the baby from the transition of the womb to the world without traumatizing it, that it is still moving and it's still loud. And one thing that I really liked from this new explanation is that, you know, the baby, the noise in the womb is kind of like the same as having a vacuum near your ears. And all of a sudden, there's nothing of that, right? And then you were telling me, which blew my mind, that, you know, it's your wife's father who invented the bed, which I think still I'm like, what? So your hook worked really well on me, where I was like, oh my God, we need to do this, this, this. And my husband came in, right? And we were just talking and chatting until I needed to wish him out because we needed to start with the podcast. So yeah, fantastic. Wow, I love it. So that's two. What's number three that you want to share?
Well, the third one, I think...
You need to read your book, right? We cannot say... Yeah.
Well, there's many, many more. But the third one is really about this idea that a lot of times when we have budget restraints or something else, we stop, right? Because we're like, oh, this is a restriction. But, you know, a lot of our research is in resource constraint settings. So people in complete poverty. And so out of necessity, they have to create their own luck all the time. And so there's a lot to learn. I will never forget, you know, the first time I went working in the Cape Flats in Cape Town around 10-ish years ago, I asked the founder of this amazing organization. They have like a low-cost education methodology. So something like 10 steps to use social media to build your business and things like that. And so I asked him, you know, I want to study you. I want to work with you. I want to collaborate. What's the one question I should never ask you? And he was, well, you know, the one question that all these people who come here ask, but that I don't want you to ask is, how can I help you? And I was like, why not? And he was like, well, if you ask me as a first question, how can I help you? Then you put me into the role of the victim, the beneficiary, someone who somehow kind of needs your benevolence. But if you come in here and say, what's already here? How can we make the best of it? Then we start at equals. And you know, that's the kind of approach they use when they go into a local community. Instead of asking, what resources do you need? They say, what's already here? There's an old garage. Fantastic. That could be a training center. There's a former drug dealer who now wants to become a better person. Perfect. Like that person, if you can turn them into a teacher, they have amazing social capital, are extremely creative. So then you kind of see more in that. And that's really kind of that idea that how can you see in every situation, not the limitation, not the scarcity, not the thing that in a way the budget restrained, but hey, okay, if I need 15 chairs for my event and I don't get the budget for it, maybe the restaurant next door is closed at that time and I just get the 15 chairs from them. That's fine. I don't even need that budget, right? And then I build a relationship with the restaurant and they get me 50% off of food next time, right? So the point is, like, it's all these kind of serendipity things that happen once you reframe yourself away from, hey, what's the kind of limitations we have here, to, hey, what is actually what we have already and how can we do something with that potentiality? And I think then it gets really interesting, because then you see potentiality everywhere and in every person. And I think, to me, I love it a lot because it's this kind of Goethe idea of how can you always see a little bit more in a situation and in a person, because then you see potentiality. And that's what serendipity is. Serendipity is potentiality. It's what could be.
Wow, that is beautiful. And it's so true. And I just like that one... You know, the change of, you know, a change of perception really is what this is, right? The third advice that you're giving. Because I always say to the people I mentor, I always say, you know, you're sitting on a train. I'm always trying to be the positive person. And even in the most horrendous situation, there's always something positive coming out. And an example of that, for example, and it would sound really horrendous, but what she did with it is just so amazing. It's a friend of mine, Mary from Luxembourg, who was really badly abused when she was a child by a family member. And she never talked about it until one moment, and she wrote a book about it, and she talked about it in Luxembourg on live TV and everywhere, right? And now she is involved in all of these community projects. She works with so many people. You know, she's working in politics now, you know, to help shape policies and things like that. And, you know, I always tell her, this is so incredible, because people, you know, it's horrendous situations, but if you look at it, what you could do with it, right, and take the bad and turn it into something good, not just for you, because it's very healing, but at the same time for others, because, you know, we share a lot of situations with other people. Our weaknesses are very likely other people's weaknesses. Our strengths are also matching with other people, right? We are kind of, we are puzzle pieces in a huge puzzle, yeah? And I like that, the what not to ask, one question not to ask, like, you know, what do you need help with? I love it, because it is true. And I've never thought about it that way, that it could become that people could feel a bit offended or as a victim, instead of saying, hey, you know, what is already there? Because it's the same, but it just is on such a positive, different level. I really like it, because I'm actually that person, and I will change that, who always asks, how can I help? And I've never perceived it as that I could make people feel uncomfortable and that they could feel victimized with that question. But now thinking about it, I'm very grateful that you were saying that. It's very true, because people, when they talk to me, they're not always, you know, they don't want to, they are intimidated or whatever. And then they don't want to tell me, oh, I don't like this. So they just go with it. But, you know, it helps me a lot to also checks and balance myself and how I talk to other people. I think this is fantastic. So I have learned already quite a lot. But
and
then
that's such a great point, right? This, because I feel exactly on this, like someone like you, who's such a wonderfully helpful person, like that then anyways later in the conversation comes, right? That it comes up how you can help, but it comes organically versus tell me now on the spot, like the three things you need from me. And the kind of people might be like, wow. Okay.
Yeah,
and so
yeah,
it's exactly,
yeah.
I'm exactly the same. And I feel like my first intuition everywhere is like, hey, I want to help. So I ask, how can I help? But then it's kind of like, oh, actually, hey, you know, the more we have a relationship, the more also then organically it emerges how the real help could look like. And it's fascinating. But also what you said earlier, I loved it because it's so much about exactly this Viktor Frankl idea that, you know, you can't always pick the situation that you're in, but you can pick in a way your response to that. And I think that's kind of, I've seen that a lot, you know, I've had now two near-death experiences by now. And each time it's exactly this, that you're saying, wow, what can I do with this situation? That's not about toxic positivity in terms of life is always so great and just manifested and that's it. No, like we realize that life is really hard and life like can be really, really bad sometimes. And then it's kind of like, okay, what of this can I not change and can I not control? So I accept it somehow and I try to go through the pain. I'm not running away from it. I'm going through it and I'm facing it. And then the other thing, what can I control now? What can I do with this? Is there something? And then focusing on this, I think it's exactly what you just said. Then you write that book about it. Then you go out there and go into politics about it. And that's kind of the really interesting thing, that then you feel agency again, right? You don't feel powerless about it, but you're like, hey, there's something I can do. And I think that's such a powerful shift. But it brings me to a really interesting point, like that whole idea that we obviously also can then never blame anyone for bad luck, right? Because bad luck can happen to everyone. Like this, like, you know, you've seen in your own life, right? How quickly, like from one day to the other, things just shift and you're like, wow, hey, wow, wow, wow. And so, of course, like when we talk about like luck, we're also talking about there's also the kind of bad luck that we can't influence and like it happens to people and like we want to have a lot of empathy with them. And so I feel like that's always so important not to see both sides. Like, yes, we can have that mindset. And at the same time, we also appreciate that there is bad luck in the world and we have to create opportunity spaces for people to not get into a bad luck dynamic. And I think, especially in poverty context, that happens a lot, right? You lose your job, then you lose your family, then you lose your heart, then you lose. And so you get into those spirals. And I think that's our responsibility, I guess, as leaders to then, you know, work on that.
Yeah, 100%, and redirect the energy.
Yeah.
But also what is important to say here, I think, is that, you know, that not, you know, how I feel about my life and the ups and downs is personal to me. And some things were horrendous and some things were great, but my horrendous is not your horrendous and not yours and yours and yours. And you know, and one thing that I always say, and I think it's important to say here as well, because it fits very well, is that don't feel like your horrendous or your great is not horrendous enough or great enough. That we stop comparing each other's lives, you know, because yes, okay, we are both very privileged. Yeah, I can say that like that. We have a house, we have food, we have healthy children, you know, we have an income and things like that. But we also have our ups and downs. And and as such, I think we need to take that for what it is for ourselves and not let other people either talk it down or inflate it to be something bigger than it is. And just give the opportunity and the right back to the people who own it and say, feel that and you can, and this is for you. And I think that is always important to say, because people, they say, well, you know, and we have seen the pandemic very much when celebrities spoke up about how they seen the pandemic and how they have lived them. Then other people who maybe don't have that big villa with the swimming pool were like, well, you know, why do you complain, right? And it's just, I get the point, but at the same time, why, you know, let's just all be human and see it a bit, how we can make something together instead of comparing who has what and how. And just as you said, right, see how we can contribute and bring opportunities to everyone within the situation with whatever we have to give, right, in whatever rank we are and hierarchy and social class. So, and that is really where the sweet spot is of serendipity as well, isn't it? Yeah. When you can bring this all together and work together with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's so beautifully said, because it's also, I think, hitting to the exact nail that serendipity, first and foremost, is also a subjective experience, right? It's kind of like, it's in a way how you interpret the situation. To give an example, right? Someone might break up with me 5 years ago in like a painful breakup. And then, you know, a few months later, I meet the love of my life. Then I would say, oh my God, thank you very much for the breakup back then. Otherwise, I couldn't have met the love of my life, right? And so it's kind of those moments where, in a way, you needed those crisis moments as inflection points, but only if you also then interpret them like this. If you would sit home now for the next like 5 years, then you would always be the person broken up with, right? Because you would not give yourself the chance to have that new thing. And so I think that's kind of, in a way, I always love this. I don't know if it's you know, I remember like telling it once to my parents, and they really didn't like me, but I like it a lot, because it kind of really, my parents are always kind of my filter, you know, I'm kind of like the Germany filter in terms of, does it work in Germany? But so it didn't work with them, but I'll still bring it up, because I've always loved it as a thought experiment. This idea that, imagine a bank robber, and hopefully, of course, it never happens. The reason they don't like it is because it's kind of like, it has a little bit of cruelty in there. But the idea is, a bank robber comes into a bank, and he shoots one shot, right? And that one shot goes through your shoulder. Okay, so you're the only person who gets like the shot here. And now, essentially, what happens is, in the thought experiment, when you ask a lucky person, how would you interpret the situation? The lucky person would say, thank you, thank you, thank you that I wasn't killed. It could have gotten so much worse. So thank you. I was so lucky that I survived the situation. An unlucky person, a Pechvogel, would say, this is so unfair that I was the only person shot. It's the story of my life that I'm always the one who was like bad and worst off. Like, I'm an unlucky person. And so the funny thing is, like, you can experience exactly the same situation, but have completely different interpretations. And I think that's kind of the interesting thing, that someone can tell you the same story, but the way they interpret it, one would tell it as a lucky story, the other one as an unlucky story. And I think that's kind of to your point, right? It's so much about subjectivity, about your own life, your own reality, how you interpret things. And we can't take that from anyone. But I think the fascinating thing is, we can work on that muscle to say, maybe we can tweak it a little bit more towards the interpreting it also as, hey, we can work from this versus this is the end of my life. And, you know, as they say, like, it's always been one of my favorite sayings, this idea that if you want a happy ending, you can't stop the story too early. If you stop the story too early, you won't get the happy ending. And I think that's kind of, in a way, the core idea behind it.
Well, there was a picture that came out. I don't know which child it was, of Prince William in the UK, when he was outside of the maternity, standing by the car, and he was he pointed on something, he did something with his fingers. So he pointed from one side, but from the other angle of the camera, it looked like he was showing the middle finger. And you see both perspectives, right? And then it said on the emoji, the motion under it said, it's all in the perspective, right? Mm-hmm. How you want to see what is happening there, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, we have it all the time. And as you say, you know, waking up, you know, your subconscious doesn't know what is real and what is not. So if you tell it, right, if you tell it positive things, this is going to happen, this is, you know, it takes it as a truth. But if you also batter yourself down the whole time, this is so bad, and I'm a horrible person, and I'm not healthy, you know, if you feed yourself the whole time with bad words and phrases and so on, it makes a real impact on your body, right? Which is about the brain science again, right? The plasticity of your brain, and how with meditation and different wordings and different states of, when you are when you're talking about these things, like Dr. Joe Dispenza style and so on, it really makes an impact. Would you agree with that?
It's interesting, right? Because to your point, I think a lot of times we tell ourselves a story of ourselves, and then that story, in a way, almost becomes reality, right? Because it's almost like these, like a quasi self-fulfilling prophecies. Like, to give an example, you know, if you're the kind of person who goes to an event and says, oh no, this is going to be a boring event. Well, most likely it will be boring for you, because you will not ask questions that are interesting. You will not kind of like give other people a chance, versus if you go to the same event and maybe switch questions, right? Maybe instead of, oh, what do you do? oh, I do this, and then everyone goes on autopilot, and like you go into this. We talked about earlier, right? The power of asking questions. If you instead of asking, what do you do? Ask something like, what do you enjoy doing? It's a very small shift, but then someone might say, you know what? I work in accounting, but what I actually really enjoy doing is, gardening and reading about Hegel. And then you might be like, oh my God, I'm a philosopher at heart too. Great. Let's talk about like philosophers. Or, you know what I mean? So it's kind of, and that's, I need to tell you about this. It's one of my absolute favorite experiments where they essentially, to exactly that point of how important it is, how you look at the world, how you view the world, they pick people who consider themselves to be very lucky. And people who consider themselves to be very unlucky. So people who say, bad things tend to happen to me, I'm always in accidents and so on. Mm-hmm. And we probably all know people on this continuum, right? From very lucky to very unlucky. And so they pick one of each group and they say, walk down the street, go into a coffee shop, grab a coffee, sit down, and then we'll have our conversation. Mm-hmm. What they don't tell them is that there's hidden cameras alongside the street and inside the coffee shop. There's a £5 note, so money, right in front of the coffee shop door. And inside the coffee shop, an empty seat next to this extremely successful businessman who can make big dreams happen. Lucky person walks down the street, sees the £5 note, picks it up, goes inside the shop, sits next to the businessman. They have a great conversation, exchange business cards, potentially an opportunity comes of it. We don't know that. Unlucky person walks down the street, steps over the £5 note, so doesn't see it, goes inside the shop, orders a coffee, sits next to the businessman, ignores the businessman. That's it. At the end of the day, they ask both people, how was your day today? Lucky person says, well, it was amazing. I found money in the street, made a new friend, and, you know, potentially an opportunity. Unlucky person just says, well, nothing really happened. And, you know, you have the same with people who go to an event. Like if you're a couple, right? One comes back and says, amazing, it was so great. And the other one, oh, no, it was boring. Sometimes it's a reflection of ourselves. And that's kind of, in a way, to your point, right? That we can construct the reality almost just how we look at life.
I need to get my husband to read this book. He's an amazing man, don't get me wrong. But he always doubts everything, and he's very cautious, and you know, doesn't open up very fast and so on. And he's always like, I'm the protector. I protect against any freeloaders and things like that. So yeah, I think a bit of serendipity would do him good. Because he's an amazing man, and I think it would do him really good. So let me ask you two more questions. One is, what holds us back for more serendipity in our life? Would you say it's just the story of the coffee shop? Or is there another magic formula where you would say, other than the three hooks, of course, the three advices you gave before, that really did it for you, what really worked for you, actually?
Yeah. Well, I'd say there's two big areas. One is really the things we talked about, right? The things we can't control. So there's, of course, societal constraints and so on. So that's something we as a society have to work on. And then there's the self-limiting biases. Then there's the kind of idea of, what do I do that holds me back? For example, imagine you sit in a meeting, you have this amazing, unexpected idea, but then you don't bring it up because you don't feel worthy, ready, perfect enough or so. And then you walk outside and you think, what could have happened had I brought the idea in? Or, you know, you're at a conference, you run into this amazing person you always wanted to speak with, but then you don't speak with her because you don't feel ready, worthy, you name it. And so what I found interesting is to really reflect on our life when you think back, when could serendipity have happened, but it didn't because we held ourselves back, right? Where we saw it could have happened. And then think about, what is the pattern behind it? Is it imposter syndrome? I work a lot with senior executives. And when you ask in a room where people trust each other, who of you has imposter syndrome or fear of rejection or something, 60, 70, 80% of hands go up, right? Because people grew so fast, right? Like a lot of people who are amazing have like this, but they channeled it, right? They work harder than for it, or they, and so it's the fascinating thing that I'm a big fan of, really trying to figure out what is the pattern behind what could hold us back. And then how can I work on this? Something that helped me a lot was when you have something like fear of rejection, right? So my brain, whenever I would be in a situation like this, my brain goes to the worst case, right? So what's the worst case if I bring up this idea? Oh, it might get shot down, or it might this and this and this. And so that was because I always thought, what's the worst thing that can happen if I do it? And then at some point I realized, but that's not the worst thing in general. Like the worst thing is the regret when you walk outside and for 5 days you think what could have happened had you. And so the reformulation, that reframing away from what's the worst thing that can happen if I do it to what's the worst thing that can happen if I don't do it? That helped me a lot, because then you have this bias for action to say, you know what? Okay, then shoot me down, but at least I don't run for 5 days around and thinking what could have happened. And so it's kind of this kind of reframing things I found really useful.
I love it. Yeah, I definitely need to work on that as well. Also, I don't know if it is a women thing, but we women, also, I know a lot of women, and I'm one of these as well, that when you are in a situation, sometimes you're just too afraid, kind of like to speak up. And then after, it's as you say, you feel regret. And I always say to my husband, I feel like I'm wearing someone else's suit. You know, it's like choking me, because I'm just like, I really want to do that. I think it's so exciting, but I'm holding myself back. So yeah, no, and I need to work on that as well. I need to definitely get into the chapters of your book. Thank you so much. My last question then to you is, you know, you wrote your own books and you do so much. Really talking to you is so calming, if I may say so. And at the same time, it's so insightful, inspiring. And I had a million other questions, but we really need to stop now. What is another book that you didn't write, of course, because people need to read your book, but something before you wrote your book, or a quote or a podcast or something that someone said to you that you should look up to get to where you are today?
Yeah, thank you. And first of all, thank you for, you know, the great conversation, the great thought. It was very fun for me too. You know, I think you, in terms of books, I can't see them here, but there's two, if I may. One is Viktor Frankl, because I think, you know, whenever I'm in a really bad place, like that's the kind of book where I'm like, okay, look, this person, and maybe to give everyone context, like he essentially survived the Holocaust, and he wrote about, well, how did I psychologically survive this? Like physiologically, of course, you didn't have a choice, but psychologically, how did I keep that hope? And so, and you know, during COVID, for example, I found it extremely useful. His strategy is to say, even in situations where there's objectively no meaning, you can subjectively create a meaning. So for example, he was in a concentration camp, which as you can imagine is the toughest situation you can, because you know you will die, you know there's no way out. And he was okay. Objectively, he has no meaning, but I will create one. The next day is I will still talk with other prisoners to make them feel better. So now I have a reason to wake up tomorrow morning. I need to talk with them. We did the same with students, for example. You know, some of my students who, you have to imagine, they came to New York from China, from India, from all these different places. And then from one day to the other, they get locked alone in their apartment, knowing no one. And like, there's no hope, right? Because nobody knew how long it would take here. New York was really shut down, completely locked down. Nobody could do anything and nobody knew anything. And so the thing then is we said, okay, is there anything we can do to still make you feel it's worth to wake up tomorrow morning? Because it just feels like, why? Like, what's the point? And so we said, okay, do you have an older neighbor, for example, who can't go to the supermarket because they would infect themselves and die? Okay, well, get them food in the morning. Now you have a reason to wake up at 8 o'clock every morning, because every morning that person needs their food and you promise them to bring the food. And so you create a responsibility, and that responsibility in a way gives you meaning again. And so I just love that about Viktor Frankl. And then last, you know, the book, my second favorite is really The Little Prince, because The Little Prince is, you know, this book where this small prince runs around and just asks why essentially all the time. And I'm a huge fan of asking why, learning from kids, because kids probably find money more often in the street than adults, right? Because they don't expect that it's not there. They just are curious. They open their minds. They open their eyes. And so I think there's a lot to learn from us, from kids in terms of asking why again more often, being more curious again, and getting out of this autopilot that kind of wheel in, right? Fight or flight, running, running, running. And then at some point we're on our deathbed and we're like, well, was that it, right? And so I think that reminder of no. Now is the life, not in 10 years when, you know, we might run in front of a car.
There's something I heard, and I love the books. I will definitely read Viktor Frankl. I didn't know about the book. Little Prince, I do. My children have all read it. There was a saying I got it in a video, which says 100 hours a year, that's around 18 minutes a day, to do something that is new to you, you know, play an instrument, do a sports or whatever it is, will bring you after the 100 hours to the 95% that you're better than 95% of the world population in that category, because of consistency, right? And I think with that, it creates also opportunity and newness. So within what you were saying, I think what I could add to that as well, to the Little Prince with the why and stay curious, is also to keep learning, do something new. You know, there's these things like Coursera, there's all of these community sports classes, and, you know, there's always something happening nowadays. You know, if you imagine that even a decade ago, it was not as busy as it is as it is now. And I think if I can give and add to your comments, I think that would be something I would leave you all with as well, to just keep learning and do something new, learn something new all the time, you know, and just explore and share it with other people. I think that would be really great. So, Christian, vielen Dank. Thank you so much. This was really, really nice. We went way over time, but I just couldn't stop talking to you. We will keep talking for sure. And this will go up very, very live, very, very soon. And I'm sure the feedback will be fantastic. So thank you for your time. After all of these scheduling, rescheduling here and there, you know, we both have very small children. And there's always something happening. The last time we needed to meet, Theodor bumped his TV in the slide outside, remember? And we need to go to the emergency room. But, you know, there's always something. And, you know, just keep trying and getting it done always brings so much newness and serendipity, isn't it? So thank you. And now I know that your father-in-law is the founder of the SNU. Holy cow. Have a really good day, and I will put all of the notes that we were talking about and also about your book, of course, in the show notes. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Bye.
Thank you. Likewise. Till soon. See you very soon. Thank you.
See you soon. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Zoom O'Clock. We hope this discussion was insightful and has provoked some new ideas for you. Please share and subscribe. If you'd like to keep in touch with your host, you can find her on Instagram under Tessie_from_Luxembourg and on Twitter under Tessie_DE.